Hello. Thank you for joining our April 30th CMS COVID-19 call with ambulatory surgical centers and freestanding EDs. We appreciate you taking time out of your busy schedules to join us today. This is Alina Chukai leading stakeholder engagement on COVID-19 in the Office of Administrator Seema Verma here at CMS. Today we are joined by numerous CMS subject matter experts who are here to answer your questions. I'd first like to turn it over to Eric Miranda Marin at the Center for Medicare. Eric, over to you.
Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone. Let me begin first by thanking each of you for the work you guys are doing to make sure that you're continuing to treat patients and contribute your resources to the healthcare system during this time. I'd also like to thank you all for joining us to discuss the flexibilities that the Department and CMS have rolled out to ensure that ASCs and independent freestanding emergency centers are able to contribute their resources as we work to address the COVID-19 public health emergency. Our healthcare system is evolving rapidly to confront the challenge this new virus poses, and ambulatory surgical centers and independent freestanding emergency centers and other provider types have a critical role to play in facilitating this evolution. This call is our opportunity to more fully address some of the questions we have received about the changes we have recently made, as well as an opportunity for us to address additional situations you may have encountered over the past several weeks. We are listening to stakeholder feedback on these programs and on the situations you are encountering, and we are diligently working to address the feedback we receive as the healthcare system rapidly evolves to meet this moment. We have provided a number of flexibilities to ASCs and independent freestanding emergency centers to ensure that we are able to capitalize on their capacity and on the extraordinary capabilities that they have to treat patients. The CMS Hospitals Without Walls initiative allows ASCs and IFECs to treat patients under arrangements with a hospital or to be temporarily become a provider-based department of a hospital to allow for more rapid triage and treatment of patients in the setting best suited to their needs. Alternatively, ASCs and licensed IFECs are now able to enroll as hospitals through an expedited enrollment process so that they can perform the full range of services for which they are appropriately resourced. We expect these changes to ensure that hospital capacity is reserved for the most complex patients or for patients suffering severe cases of COVID-19. We recognize that ASCs and IFECs are not typically large facilities, and particularly in the case of ASCs, the suspensions of elective procedures, which we recommended and which many of you diligently complied, have resulted in financial challenges to your ability to continue operation. I hope that those of you who needed assistance in this regard were able to access resources that were available in our advanced and accelerated payment program. For those of you who have not yet accessed these funds, we are no longer accepting applications for the advanced payments for Part B suppliers, and we are reevaluating all new and pending applications for our accelerated payments program. Funding will continue to be available to hospitals and to other healthcare providers on the front lines of the coronavirus response, primarily from the Provider Relief Fund. Unlike financing provided through the advanced and accelerated payment programs, these funds do not need to be repaid. If you are interested in learning more or if you require additional liquidity, please visit hhs.gov/provider-relief. We look forward to a continuing dialogue with each of you as the healthcare system continues its evolution to allow providers to focus on care and to empower patients. The feedback we receive on this call and through the numerous other communication channels we utilize will ensure that we have a robust framework in place for the healthcare system to utilize its full capacity to treat patients. At this point, I'd like to turn the call back to Alina, our moderator, so that we can hear your questions, your comments, and your concerns. We have an amazing team joining us on today's call. And while I cannot guarantee immediate answers to every question, I hope our dialogue yields insights which we can take back to address. Thank you again for the amazing work you're doing to treat and care for patients during these challenging times.
Great. Thanks, Eric. Operator, we'd like to open up the call for questions from the lines. Thank you.
At this time, if you would like to ask an audio question, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. Again, that's star 1 to ask an audio question. We will pause for just a moment to compile the Q&A roster. And your first question comes from the last four digits of the phone number are 4149. Please proceed with your question.
The question is regarding COVID-19 testing for patients getting elective procedures that are the new requirement after May 11th. Is this for all elective procedures, emergent procedures, and what is the protocol put in place?
Can I ask you to just be a little bit more specific with your question? I don't know if they muted the line already. Tiffany, are you able to address that, or should we come back for more specifics?
I think we may need a little more detail. It sounds like the question is whether there's a Medicare requirement to test patients for elective procedures. So I think we would need a little more detail as I'm not familiar with that requirement.
The line has withdrawn the question.
Okay.
And our next question comes from 0353.
My question is there a waiting period between cases for sanitation with known COVID-19 patients if we elect to take known COVID-19 patients for elective surgery?
Do we have CCSQ?
I believe Hi, this is David. Tiffany. I don't think that we have any federal Medicare guidelines on telling providers about a waiting period that I'm aware of. I don't know if our colleagues on the clinical standards and quality side have any information to share on that.
So this is Karen Tritz from the clinical standards side. I guess I would defer to CDC guidance on environmental cleaning and to address COVID. I don't know if other of my colleagues have other information they'd like to share, but we don't have anything specifically and would really refer to CDC guidance on that.
So, and hi, this is Michelle Schreiber, also from the clinical standards group. Agree with Karen to refer to the CDC guidelines. We did put out the phase one document last week about some recommendations for restarting care, but in terms of specific questions, we would also refer back to what the best CDC guidelines are. However, if you send in your question in particular, we can try to explore it further and get back to you.
Our next question comes from 8570. Please proceed with your question. Question has been withdrawn. Our next question comes from 2395.
Yes. My question is it mandatory for COVID testing to be performed on all patients?
Tiffany?
Pardon?
Yeah, this is Dave Wright. Go ahead.
No, I was going to turn it over to you. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, we do not have a requirement in place that requires COVID testing for all patients unless somebody has information that I'm lacking.
Okay. Thank you.
Our next question comes from 0730. Please proceed with your question if your phone number ends in 0730.
My question is there a resource for securing PPE as we have been under severe allotments?
This is David Wright again. What we've typically done is referred providers to their local or state health departments in terms of coordinating with them to secure supplies through the states. We don't have a role in the distribution of PPE directly through CMS.
Our next question comes from 9570. Please proceed with your question. Question has been withdrawn. Our next question comes from 6220. Please hold for your next question. Your next question comes from Ashley Green. Ashley, please proceed with your question. Question has been withdrawn. Your next question comes from Kara Newberry.
Hi, everybody. This is Kara Newberry with the Ambulatory Surgery Center Association. I first just wanted to, say how grateful we have been for the tireless work that's been done by CMS during this time from Administrator Verma down. So thank you all for your help. I did want to ask, a two-part question. Do you have any sense of how many ASCs have gone the route of enrolling as a hospital under the Hospital Without Walls program? And is further guidance coming on that program? I know that one of the attestations speaks to 24/7 nursing, and if the facility does not plan on being open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, just wanted to see how that was being handled. Thank you.
That sounds like maybe Zabeen and then David.
Hi, this is Alicia in provider enrollment. So I think we've seen about a dozen applications that have come in where the ASC is looking to convert to a hospital.
And David Wright, go ahead, Jeff.
I'm sorry, I was just going to answer the second part of her question related to if there are resources for ASCs to use. And yes, there are. There are frequently asked questions available from provider enrollment. And there's also a QSO memo from the CCSQ. And David, you can take it from there.
Yeah, thanks, Joe. So, and I'll defer to our team as well, but the 24/7 nurse requirement is something that has not been waived. And so I believe our expectation continues to be that as these facilities are voluntarily applying to serve as a hospital, that requirement would stay in effect. But again, defer to Danielle or Karen or Aaron if you guys have additional on that.
Sure. Thanks, David. This is Aaron Imhoff. I think that the thing to be clear about is there are several options for ASCs. If they are choosing to enroll on their own as a hospital during the public health emergency, then they are required to meet the hospital conditions of participation, and one of those is the 24-hour care. Now, there's other options, and I'll ask Tiffany and my colleagues in payment if I get any of this wrong, but with the Hospitals Without Walls, there's other options for ASCs if they just wanted to provide some sort of outpatient care, or not necessarily providing the 24-hour care, but that would be through partnering with a hospital doing under arrangement services or becoming provider-based to another hospital. And I'll defer to CM if there was anything that I might have missed up with that.
That's exactly right, Erin. And this is Tiffany. I'll just echo that. If there are concerns about not being able to meet the hospital conditions of participation that have been modified for the duration of the public health emergency, there are those other options that Erin just mentioned. So for both inpatient services under arrangements, as well as for outpatient services, therapeutic services as a provider-based department of a hospital, and notably, there is no limitation to the type or nature of services that can be furnished as through any of those options. So whether you're becoming a hospital yourself, the general rules of what hospitals may provide would apply. If you're becoming a provider-based hospital outpatient department, you're still able to furnish any service that a hospital outpatient department would furnish. So we think that there's a lot of flexibility there, and we certainly understand that things are moving very quickly, and there very well may be some facilities who have an ability to meet the requirements to enroll as a hospital themselves. And certainly where there's a surge capacity need to do so, we thank you for doing that, and we hope that you will. For others, where the needs may be different or the resources may be a little bit different, there are other ways to partner with hospitals as well to do hospital services. And then, of course, if those are not options, even remaining as a surgery center, there are flexibilities to do that as well. Obviously, the recommendations that have been out regarding elective procedures may have changed some of what's being done. We continue to evaluate those recommendations and are certainly happy to hear any questions, comments, concerns about further guidance or recommendations that would be helpful to hear from CMS. Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Donna Jennings.
Hello, this is Donna Jennings from Texas Health Hughley Surgery Center, and I'm calling in regards to tiered procedures and acuity of patients. Of course, we limit the acuity of patients as an ASC, but the tiered procedures, we plan on going live on May 11, and that's here in Texas. And to the best of my knowledge, that would include all elective procedures. Is that correct?
Yeah, CCSQ.
This is Marion Couch in the Office of the Administrator. I think you might want to consider a more nuanced approach in conjunction with your state and local health department. It should be based on clinical need, and so we're thinking that you might want to prioritize those planned procedures that are being backlogged based on clinical need in terms of which ones go forward first. Is that helpful?
Yes, ma'am. We weren't planning on doing certain procedures, but we just wanted to clarify from a regulatory perspective if there were strict limitations from CMS's perspective. Of course, we will prioritize the level of need. For example, say we were doing a colonoscopy, it would be a colonoscopy for need, but that wasn't considered urgent enough to be done during the previous to now. So yes, we will be prioritizing for sure. I just wanted to know if there were any legal regulatory guidance on that. So thank you.
No, thank you for asking. It's a great question. We really are asking folks, and that's what the recommendations state, based on clinical need. Those are the ones that should be prioritized to go forward. And then, of course, you want to make sure that you have enough PPE and healthy staff, et cetera, so in case you surge, you would be able to accommodate that. But otherwise, based on clinical need, you're all set to go. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am.
Your next question comes from Bonnie Reed.
Hi. My question is regarding an ambulatory surgery hospital that converted to an acute care hospital in anticipation of the surge of COVID patients. That surge never occurred, so there are no patients there, and they're planning to cease operations for a few months instead of converting back just in case there is a resurgence. And we just wanted to make sure that there was no prohibition on them temporarily closing the facility for a few months before converting back. And they did receive accelerated payments. I don't know if that has any impact, but they will obviously pay back. But just want to make sure it's okay if they cease operations for a few months and make sure there's no resurgence and then convert back to an ambulatory surgery hospital.
Yeah, this is David Wright with Centers for Clinical Standards and Quality. One thing I would recommend is they work closely with their CMS location where they're located to ensure there's not technically something that allows for a certified provider to temporarily close. So they'll need to work with their CMS regional office on making sure and, you know, going through the state to make sure that whatever they plan to do is going to be approved so that they don't wind up being in a situation where it could be considered a cessation of business that could lead to a termination from the Medicare participation. So just work with your state and through them, the CMS regional office on that issue.
Okay, thank you.
Your next question comes from line of William Prentice.
Thank you. I'm the CEO of the Ambulatory Surgery Center Association. My question was actually already answered, but I do want to take this opportunity to echo Kara's thanks to CMS and everyone at HHS, from the secretary to the administrator on down, for your hard work, you know, during these very trying times. You have been very, very helpful to the ambulatory surgery community as we've been, you know, dealing with both the postponement of surgeries and now our efforts to try and resume them. So I just want to, you know, once again, thank you all for your hard work. It's been much appreciated.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from the line of Lisa McCluskey.
Hi there. My question is regarding the CARES Act Provider Relief Fund. We did receive the first round of payments, so then I went on and went through the general distribution portal. We did receive a certificate of completion, but no email. I'm assuming if we received the certificate of completion, there's no further action we have to take, and that second round of relief funds will be forthcoming at some point in time. Is that correct?
OFN.
Hi,
Hi, this is Diane Kovac. I'm not with OFM, but I just want to clarify. Are you speaking about advanced and accelerated payments? Or are you talking about the fund that's being dispersed by HRSA?
I'm talking about the fund math, not accelerated payments. We did not apply for that. I know that's closed. I'm not talking about the accelerated payments.
Yeah. So the fund that you're talking about is not handled by CMS. It's handled by HRSA. So, unfortunately, that's not a question that we can answer.
Oh, okay. Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Your next question comes from Chandra Alfano.
Hi there. Thank you. I'm asking just a little more specifically on the topic of clinical need, as I'm sure we're all trying to interpret to the best of our ability. We're trying to take the cases, you know, moving forward, as you stated, that are clinically necessary. We're going to eventually move into the ENT and endoscopy realm, obviously COVID testing prior to and then requiring isolation prior to them coming in, et cetera. But when we're getting those cases such as arthroscopies with meniscal repairs that are documented as, you know, debilitating and necessary, we're trying to weave in and out of and follow the guidance that we're getting from CMS. But we also want to stay within those parameters and continue with social distancing, you know, and space the patients out as necessary. But is that something, I know it's kind of specific procedure, but is that something that's okay to proceed with?
This is Marian Couch again, and thank you for your question. And thank you for talking about screening your patients and testing them to the best of your ability prior to having them undergo surgeries or procedures. I think we are trying to make sure we're doing this balancing act of making sure patients are able to get in a safe way the procedures they need, knowing that not all areas have the testing capability that they need. To the extent that you can do what you described, that would be ideal. You need to protect, obviously, not only the patient, who, if they are asymptomatic carriers and undergo a procedure, might be at increased risk for adverse outcomes, but also the staff in the room when you talk about otolaryngology or dental procedures, for instance. So we, again, think that it ought to be based on clinical need, and I would guide you towards sites such as the American College of Surgery, where they talk about having a committee that can help you decide what clinical need might be most best prioritized in your community, your facility, your health system. So I think I would, we don't have regulations on that, but I think if I could point you one place, it would be to a site like the American College of Surgeons, which is very thoughtfully put out guidance, which the AMA and the AHA have supported. Have I answered your question?
Yes, thank you.
Thanks.
Your next question comes from the line of Ronald Hirsch.
Hi there. First, I'm not going to thank you, but I would like to send you a Hickory Farms gift basket if you give me your home address. Short of that, my question really is about under arrangement for surgeries. So if a ASC goes under arrangement from a hospital and they're independent, what is the hospital's obligation as far as record keeping on what happened to the patient during their stay at the ambulatory surgery center? Clearly, the ASC has its own medical record system and documentation, but must all of that then get transferred to the hospital, which creates an account, has a medical record, a billing record, et cetera, or can they just send a claim to CMS and then pay the ASC the negotiated rate?
Let me start. This is Tiffany. I'll start, and I'll turn it over to my colleagues in the Center for Clinical Standards and Quality. When an ASC is functioning under arrangement to a hospital, what is seen by CMS is the hospital claim. And so it's not considered a hybrid ASC hospital service or anything other than a hospital service. So the arrangements are between the provider. So in this case, it would be between the hospital and the ASC.
but there would be no bill, no facility bill from the ASC to Medicare. It would only be the hospital billing for a service that was furnished to it under arrangements by another entity. In terms of medical record keeping and documentation, I'll turn it over to David Wright.
And Aaron, would you mind taking that one?
Sure, and I'll defer to Danielle, my colleague Danielle Adams, who's also on the line, if I get this wrong. But what Tiffany said is correct. They would be considered a hospital patient at that point, which is under the hospital's control. Danielle, I don't know if there's anything else you want to add in terms of documentation or anything.
No, I would just add on that they would be subject to whatever the medical records requirements that hadn't already been waived by the hospital. Is what they would have to follow in that.
Okay, thank you very much.
Your next question comes from the line of Camilla Bonta.
Hi, thank you. This is Camille Bonta, and I'm calling on behalf of the American Society for Gastrointestinal Endoscopy. I also want to echo what others have said and thanking you for holding today's call and the other weekly calls and all the tremendous amount of work that the agency has been doing to help providers. We also appreciate the recognition that the COVID has had, the financial impact on ASCs that have had to suspend non-urgent procedures, which has led to most endoscopy centers closing their doors. Resumption of procedures is slowly occurring in ASCs across the country, and ASGE has developed clinical guidance for reopening endoscopy centers. I wanted to loop back around to the first question that was asked today that is relevant to reopening, and I believe what that caller was asking had to do with Medicare coverage of COVID pre-procedure testing for those ASCs that are conducting COVID testing on site prior to procedure. I assume this will fall under medical necessity and will be reimbursed, and there won't be any challenges there, but I think that's where the first caller was, that's what his question was centering on. Do you have any additional guidance with respect to coverage of pre-procedure testing? And I don't know if this will come up, but, you know, if a Medicare beneficiary had a COVID test and then they're coming in for a procedure, maybe that COVID test was, a week ago or 2 weeks ago, that there aren't going to be any issues with retesting that patient.
CCSQ.
Your next question comes from a line of Julie Mayer.
Let us answer that one first. This is Tiffany. I'm not sure that we have the right folks on the call to answer that specific question, but I think we do better appreciate what the question was, which is, you know, sometimes there is a medical need to test the same patient for COVID-19 more than once, and whether there will be any coverage restrictions on that. Is that the question? Or we may have lost that caller, but let us take that back. I think the caller was right. The underlying rules about services being reasonable and necessary and providers and practitioners being able to document the medical necessity have not changed. And so what I heard described broadly sounded like the description was of a medically necessary test and service. So we can take that back and see if that's somewhere where we can give more guidance as well. Thank you.
And this is Marion Couch again. And the last part of your question about whether the beneficiary got tested a week or two prior to the procedure, I really think you want to be careful and test as close to the procedure as you can, and also add in a quarantine for that patient just to be as safe as you possibly can. Thanks.
And your next question comes from Julie Meyer.
Hi, good afternoon. We're an ambulatory eye surgery center located in Cleveland, Ohio. And I was wondering if there's any special requirements starting back up with our elective procedures for general anesthesia to be offered.
This is Marion Couch again. I'm not sure I understand. Can you elaborate on that question?
As far as an elective procedure, if we do a general anesthesia, are there any other special requirements other than the safety protocols of PPE that we need to require for our anesthesiologists and CRNAs to intubate and place LMAs for our patients?
I would refer you to the CDC for that. We do have concern that there might be aerosolization of virus particles for intubation procedures, for instance, so you'll want to follow the CDC guidance on that. Thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Your next question comes from Susie Oki.
Hi, this is Fred Turner, and we've got a question about our ASC. We suspended operations temporarily for less than 30 days in light of COVID, and we are prepared to resume operations now and just want to understand what notification process is required for CMS and AAAHC. Thank you.
Yeah, this is David Wright. I'll address at least part of that based on the previous answer we gave, and that is if you had notified the state survey agency that does your licensure of your temporary closure, and if there's communication with the CMS regional office, would just encourage you to circle back on that. Otherwise, I don't think that there's a specific requirement, and our team can correct me if I'm wrong, that there's any particular notification made other than that if you're otherwise resuming normal operations.
Good. Okay. Thank you.
Your next question comes from Danielle Sparks.
Yes, my question also goes back to the preoperative testing. So you did clarify a little bit of that as far as the coverage under medical necessity. But our question still remains with specific coding guidance. Do you know if CMS is planning on issuing, since the routine pre-op testing is currently not covered by Medicare, will there be any additional coding guidance for ordering physicians?
I'm not sure that we have someone who can answer that specific question. I do think it's an important question, so let us take that back.
Sure. Thank you.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from Mark Hood.
Yes, I have a very specific question about testing and our CLIA license. There are machines available that will do COVID testing and provide rapid results. However, they are considered moderate to high complexity. Our license allows us to do low complexity testing. Are there any options to use the machine such as that with our current CLIA license?
Hi, this is David Wright. No, unfortunately. So there are devices that do allow testing under a certificate of waiver. And so there are some of those available on the market, but if it's been classified by FDA as requiring moderate to high complexity labs to be able to perform those testing, then CLIA follows those recommendations and guidance in terms of the restrictions on what you can do under the specific certificate. So the short answer is unfortunately, no, you're not able to run any tests that require otherwise moderate or high complexity under a certificate of waiver.
Thank you.
Your next question comes from Diana Buck.
Hi, my question is regarding the extended use of face masks in the surgery centers.
Most of the CDC guidance is focused on healthcare settings that are dealing with COVID-19 patients. Even though ASDs will be screening all patients and staff who enter the facility for COVID symptoms, our ASDs to assume all patients may be potentially infected and so should follow all those guidelines, such as everyone wearing a face mask at all times. And if so, is it appropriate at this time of PPE shortage for example, like the OR team, to wear the same surgical mask for multiple low-risk cases like eyes instead of wearing a new mask each case? Or how is CMS allowing ASDs to loosen some of the restrictions that were previously placed on reusing PPE?
This is Marion Couch again.
Go ahead, Marion. Thank you.
Well, David, please. I would just say that we follow CDC recommendations. CMS would not set those. So please follow CDC guidance. And what we can do is make sure that we are working with CDC so that they're answering those types of very important questions that you just asked. But we would not be regulating that. That is CDC. And David, did you have anything you wanted to add?
Yeah, that's correct. I would also say, though, FDA, I'm aware, did issue some guidance on reuse of certain PPE and gowns, and so I would recommend that you go and check the FDA site as well in terms of those recommendations for certain PPE reuse.
Our next question comes from Camilla North. Camilla, your line is open. We have no response from that line. We'll proceed to the next question. Your next question comes from Trudy Wigg.
Yes, this is Trudy Wigg from Curlin Job, and I wondered if you could speak to CMS conducting surveys for compliance with the reopening of ASCs here in California. Is that being done around the country or out here, or is that false information?
So this is David Wright. We'd need a little more information on that. So the surveys that we've authorized since March 23rd include immediate jeopardy surveys, as well as what are called focus infection control surveys. I know that specific to California, they are doing more focused infection control surveys. I don't think that we've issued explicit guidance to the states with regard to reopening surveys, so it could be something that they're doing under their state licensure, but if you want to follow up with us via email, we'll be happy to look into that a little bit more.
All right. Thank you very much. And we do appreciate everything you guys have done for us. It's a lot of
and
work
likewise.
In a short amount of time. So thank you.
Likewise. Thank you all very much.
Your next question comes from Melinda Gill.
Hi. My name is Melinda Gill. I work for Orchard Hills Pediatric Dental Surgery Center. We treat only pediatric dental cases, which, of course, puts us in the highest risk category. Dentistry has considered essential still in the state of Washington, so our ASC has not been permanently closed, but we've basically not seen any cases in the interim of the last 6 weeks. My question is, will we call to see if we would qualify for the CARES Act through the HHS, and we're told no because it only is offered for Medicare, and we are Medicaid certified. I'm curious if you guys know any sort of chance that that act is going to be extended to Medicaid and why they selectively only issued it to Medicare, not Medicaid.
This is Eric. I'm not sure that we have the right folks on the call. I think OFM, I welcome you guys to take a stab at it, but the General Provider Relief Fund is being managed sort of at the department level in coordination with HRSA. OFM, do you have anything to add?
I actually don't think OFM, our Office of Financial Management, is on this call, but it is correct that the only thing that CMS is administering is the advanced and accelerated payments, and the provider relief fund is being done, as Eric said, through HRSA.
I guess my question is to you, because I couldn't get clarification from HHS when I called and talked to the people there directly. They mentioned we were not qualified for that because we are Medicaid providers, not Medicare providers, but my understanding is it's all under the same umbrella. Is that not correct?
Again, we're not the experts. I'm sorry, go ahead, Eric.
Yeah, so again, I'm not sure that we have the right people on this call to get at your question, but if you want to send me an email and I can see to it that I can direct your question to the appropriate people so that you can get a response, and you can reach me at Eric, E-R-I-C, dot Miranda, M-I-R-A-N-D-A, dash Marin, M-A-R-I-N, at hhs.gov.
Yeah, and this is Tiffany. We also have a COVID resource box that we've been directing folks to just to make sure that we can queue all of these questions appropriately. So I think it's, Eric, if you don't mind, if it's fine for her to use that inbox. It's covid-19@cms.hhs.gov. And so the email box that's posted online.
Thank you. Do you mind repeating that a little slower?
Sorry. COVID-19@cms.hhs.gov.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And I appreciate you guys' time. You guys have a great day.
You too.
Your next question comes from Shay Vaughn.
Hi, I just wanted to ask, regarding the Hospitals Without Walls, has CMS issued any specific billing requirements for how those claims should be submitted, or is there the understanding that they should be submitted as hospital claims on the UB04 in electronic format?
I can start, and I'll turn it over to the provider billing group. So, Hospitals Without Walls, the initiative is rather broad and includes lots of things. So I believe that what you're talking about is when a facility enrolls temporarily as a hospital. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. For example, an ambulatory surgery center.
Mm-hmm. So when that happens, when that facility is enrolled as a hospital, it would be using the same claim institutional claim form that hospitals use. And so it's no longer for purposes of Medicare for that time that it's enrolled at as a hospital, it's no longer submitting the claim forms that ASDs typically submit. Does that help?
Okay.
And I think there are condition codes that I'll let Diane talk about which condition code should go on those claims.
So the general answer is right. This is Diane Kovac, that you would bill as a hospital. And for purposes of the condition code, I think, Tiffany, you're referring to the DR disaster-related condition code. And so that is, okay, so right. So that condition code is used when there are any claims that are submitted that are under the umbrella of a formal waiver. And so I know there are some questions about whether the DR should be used in every instance. I would say if you believe that it is under a formal waiver, then go ahead and put it on your claims. It will not hurt anything to have it on there.
Okay. All right, great. So there's no other special identifiers that should point out that this is a temporary situation for an ambulatory surgery center to bill as a hospital without walls.
Right, because in this case, you'll be enrolled as a hospital, so you would bill as a hospital.
Okay, great. Thank you for all of your help.
And we'll take our final question, please. Hello?
Hi, we can hear you.
Oh, I'm so sorry. My name is Tricia Frank. I'm an administrator of an ophthalmology surgery center in California. And my question is regarding reopening, if our local numbers of COVID-19 cases have not followed that 14-day downward trend. What is CMS's standpoint on reopening, and do surgery centers risk non-payment from CMS for performing elective surgeries in this instance?
This is Marion Couch. So you're describing a community where there's not 14 days of declining or stable numbers. You're not a low incidence area for phase one?
Correct.
Yeah, so I think you need to be very careful about that. I don't think we have specific guide or regulations on non-payment, but I really think you need to be careful if you've not met the gating criteria, and then you're in phase one. That's all I can say.
Do you have any suggestions in terms of that gating criteria as far as what would be considered stable cases, like a certain number of new cases per day versus a much larger number, or...
You know, I would really recommend you reach out to your state and local public health officials and be sure to partner with them, because they're the ones that are really going to be thinking deeply about this, and you're going to want to be connected with them. So I think I would direct you to your public health officials.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you for your question. Eric, any final remarks before we proceed to close the call today?
I just want to thank everyone for again, taking the time out of their day to join the call and talk to us, let us know what you are encountering and the questions that you have. We've gotten a lot of good questions here, and I know we have some things to take back and further chew on and assess, and we will do that. We look forward to continuing our dialogue, and to the extent that you encounter any other problems, I think we gave the inbox earlier that you can send your questions and emails to, but can we just repeat that one more time so that folks have it?
Absolutely. That inbox is covid-19@cms.hhs.gov. And again, we'll encourage you to continue to join our office hours every Tuesday and Thursday at 5 p.m. Eastern, where we have all of our CMS subject matter experts on the line to answer your questions. This concludes today's call. Hope you all have a great rest of your day. Thank you.